Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. What is the impact of Russia's invasion of Ukraine on post-Soviet space and the role of Russia intervening in conflicts? But first, what has been the human cost of the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Since the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February, a vicious war of aggression and occupation has devastated the nation. Determined resistance to the invasion has denied Russia many of its intended targets, but Ukrainians have suffered tremendous losses. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has detailed in a report filed June 6th that 4,253 Ukrainians have been killed and 5,141 have been injured. This includes 1,600 men and 1,100 women verified and about 1,300 whose sex has not been determined. Most of the civilian casualties recorded were caused by the use of explosive weapons with a wide impact area, including shelling from heavy artillery and multiple launch rocket systems and missile and airstrikes. And the Human Rights Commissioner has stated the actual number is likely considerably higher because many of the areas of the nation have not been reachable by UN officials. And in addition, 4.5 million Ukrainians, roughly 10% of the total population, have fled the nation as refugees. On today's show, we will discuss this Russian aggression against Ukraine and the human cost of this war. Our guests are Sergei Kudelia, Associate Professor of Political Science at Baylor University. He is the author of When Numbers Are Not Enough, The Strategic Use of Violence in Ukraine's 2014 Revolution, and the forthcoming How They Joined Militants and Informers in the Armed Conflict in Ukraine. And Timothy Brick, rector and assistant professor of sociology and economic history at Kyiv School of Economics. He is the co-author of Attitudes About Privatization and the Shadow of Communism, 25 Years of Anti-Market Skepticism, and God is With Us, Christian Nationalism and Anti-Vaccination. He continues to lecture in Kyiv, even as the bombs fall. Thank you both for joining us. Timothy Brick, I know you've written about and spoken about teaching in this conflict zone, teaching in a country that's being invaded. Can you tell us what some of those experiences have been like?
Well, it's a big question. It's very difficult to explain what we have gone through. And I think that teaching is just a part of what we have been doing. So I work at the university, and I have to say that with our colleagues, with our students, we felt that we're just part of our communities. We're part of Ukraine, and we wanted to do something to contribute. So most of us were doing not exactly teaching, but we were doing other things like as volunteers. We tried to help territorial defense or people who were displaced, you know, to help them with shelter or with food, or people who were disabled. So we were doing quite a lot of activities. And our university also participated in fundraising. So we were able to fundraise more than $25 million to purchase and to deliver medical kits. We pivoted quite a lot. We focused our attention on many different activities just to support Ukraine, Ukrainian nation. And at the same time, it was important for us to preserve our academic integrity. Yeah, we wanted to remain academics. We wanted to remain professionals, to do what we like to do, and is to teach and to do research. And I think for me personally, I was watching videos and I was talking to my friends from Kharkiv. Kharkiv is a city in the east of Ukraine, and it has suffered quite a lot from shelling, from bombs. And I'm a sociologist, and the headquarters of the Sociological Association of Ukraine is located in Kharkiv. So, you know, I was watching bombs falling on the central universities of this city. So I think I just wanted to do something to show my solidarity with these people, empathy, and to show some support. And surprisingly, small things matter. You know, even if you just do some small things, like an online workshop, or some sort of a little gathering with students and professors, it really matters a lot just in terms of support and emotional resilience. So this was there were some small things that we were starting to do. And then eventually we realized that there is a demand for that, that other people, you know, they also want to participate in, even during the war, other people also want to get knowledge, to share knowledge, to discuss knowledge. So yeah, so we just kept doing that. And we felt that it is not also, there are other layers of this story. So yeah, we can talk about just regular education and teaching, but also science is a part of a bigger picture. It's a part of culture and it's a part of diplomacy. It's a part of how our country is perceived and positioned in the world. So we felt that it was important for us to talk to our colleagues abroad, you know, to organize panels, to participate in panels, to discuss things. And we created this YouTube channel called Global Minds for Ukraine. So we started inviting international intellectuals to share their ideas in the, to discuss what they, you know, what they want to discuss, but to put it in the context of Ukraine. So we had people like Paul Krugman, who is Nobel laureate, or Daniel Kahneman, Anna Applebaum, Fiona Hill, Slavoj Žižek. So, you know, we were able to invite these intellectuals to show solidarity with Ukraine, but also to show that it is important to share and discuss knowledge now. We don't need to wait until the war ends. This is exactly the moment when we should do, you know, what we aspire for. Education and science is important now in conflict. Yeah.
And maintaining identity, you know, maintaining that connection, maintaining life has to be such a challenge, but so terribly, terribly important. Now, Sergey Kudelia, we're hearing reports of what Russia's policies of aggression, you know, have indicated, that they've been denied some of the military targets they seem to have, you know, desired at the beginning of the war. And instead, that seems to have led to an even greater amount of Russian brutality within Ukraine. Is this just the regular cost of war, or has this been strategic on the part of the Russians, do you believe?
Well, many scholars, social scientists, believe that there is a strategy behind the use of force that we've seen from the Russians. There certainly was a discrepancy in the type of violence that we've seen in the northern part of Ukraine and in the southern part of Ukraine. At least from what we've seen reported, the brutalities that happened in Kyiv Oblast, the brutalities that happened in Chernihiv were much, much worse than what we've seen happening in the southern part of Ukraine. And in fact, many view the violence against civilians in the northern parts of Ukraine as an evidence of possibly a genocidal campaign against the Ukrainian people. The numbers that you gave us are certainly estimates coming from the United Nations, and they very much underestimate the actual casualty rate of the civilians in Ukraine. But even with these numbers, and the numbers were about 4,000, you see that the extent of civilian casualties is far greater just in the last 3 months than what we've seen over the last 8 years of Russia's war in Donbas. In addition to the casualty rates among civilians, of course, we have a very significant casualty rate among Ukrainian soldiers. There are no official numbers, but Zelensky gave an estimate of 100 to 200 soldiers killed every day. If that has been the rate, we are basically looking at over 10,000 Ukrainian soldiers who were killed just in the last 3 months. And just to remember for those of our listeners and viewers who were not following the events in Donbas closely over the last 8 years, 10,000-11,000 was an estimate for the total casualty rate people killed in the Donbas conflict over the last 8 years on both sides, among the separatists and among the Ukrainians. So again, the size of the murder that we've seen in Ukraine done by the Russians is extreme and is unprecedented. And I think in addition to the killings and in addition to the suffering of the civilians, we also have to take into account the broader effects of the Russian invasion. And these effects deal both with the millions and millions of Ukrainians who left their homes, who were forced out, who were forced either to relocate within Ukraine or who were forced to resettle outside of Ukraine. And you have an estimate of about 6 million with 8 million internally displaced and 6 million refugees, so over 10 million people actually left their homes, were forced out of their homes by the Russian invasion. What it means is that we have millions and millions of Ukrainians, about a third of the entire adult population, who have no place to live, who probably lost their basic means of existence. They lost their jobs. They were separated from their loved ones, because you see a lot of families that are being divided. In Ukrainian policy does not allow men to leave the country prior to the age of 60. So you have a lot of families that are being divided right now. And you see basically lives broken because of the Russian invasion. Ukrainian economy over the last 4 or 5 years has been growing. Since 2014, we've seen economic growth. We've seen an increase in real incomes of the population. So Ukraine was actually on the upward direction as far as the economy is concerned. This year alone, the projections are about 40 to 50% drop in Ukraine's GDP. Again, this is the effect, the direct effect of the Russian invasion that will lead to a significant increase in the level of poverty of Ukrainians, where people would lose their ability to survive and would need to depend to a greater extent on social assistance that would come from the state. And that also means disruption in the lives of children, the educational opportunities that are lost for children, the effect on both primary or high school students and university students, right? So you have these multiple ramifications of the Russian invasion that severely damage the capacity of Ukrainians, of Ukrainian society to develop in the near term.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing the human cost of Russia's invasion of Ukraine with Sergei Kudelia of Baylor University and Timothy Brick of the Kiev School of Economics. And Timothy, being in Kyiv, I know that at the beginning of the war, it looked like there was this huge push on the part of the Russians to take the capital city, the huge column, you know, that was directed towards Kyiv. That has been removed, and we get the image in the U.S. that, okay, Kyiv is now safe. Leaders have traveled to Kyiv, but of course, evidence of just atrocities, you know, in the areas outside of Kyiv certainly has been presented. So I guess two questions kind of tied. The first is, how normal, you know, is Kyiv? I mean, is that a false impression that Kyiv is now safe since the Russians have withdrawn? And what's been revealed about what the Russian advance on Kyiv, the impact of that advance?
I think people try to normalize their lives. Yeah. So right now, Kyiv looks as a much safer place than it was. You know, I live in a nice neighborhood. I'm quite privileged and lucky in this sense. I can drink coffee, which I like, and I can take Uber to my office to work. So in this sense, I feel quite secure and like I'm living a normal life, which sometimes makes me feel, you know, even sad and guilty when I'm thinking about other places in Ukraine that are not so privileged. And I think this is a very common sentiment now in Ukraine, that a lot of people every day, they doubt and they think that, am I doing enough, you know, to help to others? This has been a very common sentiment. And we had a popular comedian, a stand-up comedian, who actually volunteered to be in territorial defense. And he had a bit saying that, you know, he felt bad that he's doing nothing, that he's just a guy from the industry. So he went to army, and then he was put just to do some routine job to secure a warehouse or something like that. And he thought, like, well, but other Ukrainians there, at least they work as entrepreneurs, or they pay taxes, they keep economy running, while I'm doing nothing here as soldier. So, you know, we always kind of downplay what we do. And this has been a very common sentiment. So that's actually a point to your second question. What this attack on Kyiv revealed, I think it revealed something that I underestimated, the idea of unity, that so many people are united and are ready to support each other. You know, when we think about big cities, capitals, like think about New York, you know, it's always this impression that individuals in the cities there live their own lives. They don't mind about anything else. They just don't care. And I did not realize how much it is important for people in Kyiv to support each other, to help each other. You know, I was walking around and I saw the luxurious restaurants. They were just cooking food for soldiers or for displaced people or for people who were left alone because there were, you know, young people who left, but their grandparents stayed. So the restaurants were cooking food and delivering food for free. I was a member of this volunteering group when we were just using simple Google Docs and forms just to place alarms. You know, if someone needs something, like I know that there is an elderly person who lives in this part of the city and they need this medicine. It is posted on Google Doc. So anyone can just pick this order and then deliver it to the person. So, you know, people were doing quite a lot of these volunteering activities. I was pleasantly surprised. And I think this, what this war revealed to me, the strengths of civil society. And, you know, I even felt ashamed because I'm a sociologist. I should know about civil society and its strengths. And yet when you see it with your own eyes, it really, it's a life-changing experience. And another thing which was revealing to me is that, and again, as a sociologist, again, I should have known about that, but structures and institutions, they also matter. It's not just about intangible things and human connections. It's also about how logistics and supplies are organized. And apparently Kyiv was very well organized in this sense. You know, we had supply chains worked quite well. We had food in the shelter on the shelves. Even in the most daring days, it was possible to go to the, you know, a shop and to buy milk and bread. So in this sense, Kyiv managed quite well to be secure, to be well organized, and to be quite disciplined. It took some guts to do that, but I think we managed. Yeah.
Sergei, what Timothy highlighted, this question about unity, is something that keeps coming out in news reports. Ukraine was a pretty deeply divided society. From my understanding, you know, prior to the war, there were some political, definitely political and social cleavages, including, for instance, Russophones that's being reported in places like Donbas that are kind of switching sides and siding, you know, with Ukrainians. So I guess, first off, I don't know how well you can answer this, but how accurate are those reports that some of these divisions really have been overcome, and there's been a tremendous unity on the part of Ukrainians, including Russophones, who maybe Putin had counted on supporting him, not supporting him, and instead siding with Ukraine.
Let me just start with maybe clarification that based on the research we've seen over the last two decades, language is less of a predictor of someone's political behavior or political preferences than your place where you live, location, your region. Region is a much stronger predictor. That means that, for example, a Russian speaker in Western Ukraine, in Lviv, would politically behave and would have similar political preferences to other Ukrainian speakers in Lviv than to Russian speakers in, let's say, Donbas or Crimea. And the same goes for Eastern Ukraine. So if you are a Ukrainian speaker who lives in Donbas, your political preferences would be similar to those who are Russian speakers in Donbas rather than Ukrainian speakers in West Ukraine. So for that reason, this simple cleavage based on language is not really very effective as far as describing political reality is concerned and behavior of Ukrainian voters. Now on the second point, yes, absolutely. For quite some time, especially since the Orange Revolution, regional cleavages have been intentionally politicized. And we've seen consolidation of major political blocs in Ukraine around, roughly speaking, regional lines, where you look at the right bank of Dnieper and the left bank of Dnieper, and you see that there was a strong preference for one political force on one side and a strong political preference for a set of pro-Western political forces on the other side. But we also have to remember that these cleavages were politicized by actors, by political elites. They were not natural in the sense that they were not objectively existing. And that means that that has been an outcome of political manipulation and strategic rhetoric on the part of political actors. 2014 changed a lot. And we've seen in the surveys, in multiple surveys, that for quite some time, there is a greater coalescence of voters around a set of similar values. For example, prior to 2014, you have a rough divide between about 30-35% of Ukrainians who favored union with Russia, economic union. Another 35-40% of Ukrainians preferred to have membership in NATO or see Ukraine join the European Union. After 2014, especially after 2017-18, so in the last year, a year or two of Poroshenko's presidency, we've seen a significant increase in support for the membership in European Union and NATO, and a substantial drop in the support for union with Russia, even in those regions of Ukraine that originally have been favoring closer ties with the Russian Federation. That means that we've seen a substantive shift in political preferences of Ukrainians in different regions, and a coalescence, as I said, around a set of shared values. The kind of unity that Timofey describes and that we've seen in the videos of, let's say, Ukrainians in Kherson protesting against Russian occupation openly, right, in front of Russian soldiers and tanks. And again, Kherson is has been a region that voted for pro-Russian political force, Party of Regions, for quite some time. Or we've seen the same outbursts of support in Kharkiv. And Kharkiv has been a city, a stronghold of the Party of Regions for a very long period of time and has been known for very strong pro-Russian sentiments or even pro-Soviet sentiments. These types of expressions are the result of this gradual evolution of the mindset of Ukrainian voters, of their preferences, that ultimately produced the result that we've seen, for example, in the survey in January of this year, where voters were, or Ukrainian citizens were asked, would you defend your country if there is an attack coming from Russia? And in all regions of Ukraine, we've seen a majority of Ukrainians saying, yes, we are willing to actually fight to protect Ukrainian sovereignty. And so if you follow this evolution, that type of unity that we are seeing today in the streets of different Ukrainian cities probably would not come as a surprise. But again, this is something that researchers have long been pointing to in their studies.
My last question, Timofey, I'll ask you, at this point in this conflict, what kind of conclusions are you drawing about Ukrainian resistance? I know there's been a great deal of reporting that the Ukrainians have shown tremendous resolve. Technology gap between Russia and Ukraine, the amount of weapons are going to make it increasingly difficult for Ukrainians to resist. Is there hope in Ukraine?
Well, what else we have? What else we've got? No, of course, there is still a high sentiment and even commitment to resistance in the Ukrainian society. It's very difficult to run any surveys at the moment, you know, due to the movements, geographical mobility, which was discussed by Sergei earlier. You know, so many people are displaced, they were forced to become migrants. So we don't, you know, we don't have a solid base for decent surveys now. Nevertheless, there are some projects that perform online polling, or CATI polling by phones. So these surveys, they usually show a strong commitment and even enthusiasm of Ukrainian population, that people are, you know, committed to the idea that Ukraine should win, that they trust to the government and to the military in this effort. So yeah, so there is still this sense of sort of energy among Ukrainians. The question is, of course, I mean, how long can it be? And what are the institutional and structural forces that can help Ukrainian society to sustain this level of optimism and commitment? And I think there is one point which we have not discussed yet. Yeah, we were discussing Ukrainian patriotism, we were discussing civil society, we were discussing political and national identities. But I think it is also important to discuss the patterns of local governance. So in 2014, 2015, a new reform, a very significant structural reform was started in Ukraine. This was a reform of decentralization, which allowed or facilitated an emergence of new local communities in Ukraine. So local towns and cities, they were amalgamated into communities. This has been a significant shift in Ukrainian economy, not only economy, but political economy and even cultural spheres. So because of these new communities emerged, people received more incentives to develop businesses. People became more committed to their local territories. People became more satisfied with quality of local civil servants and some services. To be honest, we don't have solid data here. This is just my gut feeling and my interpretation. But I feel that it's also a part of the equation, that when people really fight for their land and when people are ready to defend their city mayors that are abducted, it's partially because they are very, you know, motivated, because they're members of the communities, because of their strong national identity. But it is also partially because they want to defend their local territories, because they're satisfied and they were quite happy with how these local territories were organized. So I'm not surprised that Ukrainians were committed to defend this land. And I think it's important to think about it, you know, when we are discussing the future, that we want Ukraine to win this war, we want Ukraine to prevail, but we also want Ukraine to maintain its democratic institutions and to maintain its local governance, because it's very important for people at the local level to receive, you know, democratic and economic means to live their lives.
It's a wonderful place to stop at this point. Our guests today have been Sergei Kudelia. He is Associate Professor of Political Science at Baylor University. He's the author of When Numbers Are Not Enough, The Strategic Use of Violence in Ukraine's 2014 Revolution, and the forthcoming How They Joined Militants and Informers in the Armed Conflict in Ukraine. And Timothy Brick, Rector and Assistant Professor of Sociology and Economic History at Kyiv School of Economics. He's the co-author of Attitudes About Privatization and the Shadows of Communism, 25 Years of Anti-Market Skepticism, and God is With Us, Christian Nationalism and Anti-Vaccination. Thank you both for joining us. Coming up, is Russia a benevolent partner to its former Soviet partners, or has it been an imperial invader? We examine this question coming up next. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Since the February Russian invasion of Ukraine, the impact extends beyond just those two nations. Russia has dominated the post-Soviet space, the independent nations that were once a part of the Soviet Union. Russian foreign policy has attempted to ensure that the nation is the indispensable partner to each of these nations. This invasion of Ukraine, though, has fractured the image and poses significant challenges to Russian influence over its former Soviet partners. On today's show, we will explore the impact of the war on Russia's role in conflicts in the post-Soviet space and how it's called into question Russia's influence in the area, as well as its historic role within these nations. Our guests today are Anna Ohanian, Richard B. Finnegan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Stonehill College. She's the editor of Russia Abroad, Driving Regional Fracture in Post-Communist Eurasia and Beyond. And her latest book, due out in August, is The Neighborhood Effect, The Imperial Roots of Regional Fracture in Post-Communist Eurasia. And Erica Marat, Associate Professor and Chair of the Regional and Analytic Studies Department at the College of International Security Affairs, National Defense University. She's the author of The Politics of Police Reform, Society Against the State in Post-Soviet Countries, and a recent piece, Time to Question Russia's Imperial Innocence. Thank you both for joining us. Anna Ohanian, Russia has played a role in peacekeeping. I know in particular in the Caucasus has been a number of areas around this post-Soviet space. First of all, how accurate is that description that their image and the potential of their role has really taken a hit, and what kind of impact could that have?
Actually, within the post-Soviet space, if we look at the post-Cold War period, Russia's policy capacity of intervention has shifted dramatically over the years, but I think it's safe to argue that Russia has demonstrated significant capacity to fuel conflicts at a certain other level that it is comfortable of controlling, and also using those conflicts as levers to project global power. Up until the war in Ukraine, this has been a very specific signature. As to its effectiveness of peacekeeping, the mandate of Russian peacekeeping interventions varies from conflict to conflict. But overall, and this is really well demonstrated in the case of the Nagorno-Karabakh war in 2020, Russia within the post-Soviet space has a capacity of providing security, meaning it can stop an ongoing violence, at least before Ukraine. What Russia does not have, and historically, actually, even within the Soviet Union, it has been able to provide sort of coercively, perhaps, a certain level of security in its various peripheries. And we can talk for hours about the Soviet federalism, etc. But at the same time, Russia can provide security, but it does not have any sophisticated toolkit of peace building, putting conflict diplomacy, and often it lacks the political will to do so, but it's much harder to research and so then to speak about the lack of capacities. But again, in the South Caucasus, during the war in Nagorno-Karabakh in particular, even before the invasion in Ukraine, there's some more conspiracy theories that are floating around, some more substantiated than others, this growing suspicion that Russia actually is not Armenia's strategic partner, that Russia, even with the CSTO, does not want or lacks the capacity to actually provide, even protect the basic territorial integrity of states. So even before the war in Ukraine, I think Russia's image was already under fire.
Erica Murat, Anna suggests this is a question of capacity, of, you know, capabilities, possibly, you know, as well a question of motivation. How much has Russia's, you know, the sort of the hit to Russia's image also been really a question about the legitimacy of Russia serving that role as kind of peacemaker in the post-Soviet space?
So I completely disagree that Russia is a peacemaker or has any kind of peacemaking capabilities in neighboring countries and also around the world. Russia is an imperial power, and the war in Ukraine is manifestation of its sense of imperialism. Russian society and Russian political elites never had a difficult discussion about Russian history and the type of violence that Russia engaged in its neighborhood in order to fulfill its imperial ambition. And whenever Russia engages in neighboring countries, be that Ukraine, Nagorno-Karabakh, Kazakhstan, or in countries like Syria or African countries, it is really to fulfill this global imperial ambition of Russia presenting itself as a strong power that is capable to challenge the West. Its involvement in Nagorno-Karabakh is only to fulfill its imperial ambition as well. I don't think if there were no immediate interests for Russia in keeping Armenia close to Moscow, in keeping Azerbaijan under control, under its influence, I don't think Russia would have been as much involved in Nagorno-Karabakh. And I'm saying this because as a Central Asian, there were several times in Central Asia when leaders openly appealed to Putin to please send troops to solve ethnic conflicts or political tensions, including, you know, members of CSTO, and Russia never did. Russia never did send troops in order to stop violence. It only engaged in Kazakhstan in January. It was a very low-cost engagement because it served its immediate political interests.
So, Anna, you had suggested that you called it a bit of a conspiracy theory about the relationship between Russia and Armenia. Russia's always had a pretty strong relationship with Armenia. Has that been fractured? And I guess, you know, two potential points would be, 2020, obviously, Russia kind of sat on the sidelines, you know, during the initial stages of the attack. And then this, of course, the invasion of Ukraine.
In 2020, Russia did not sit on the sidelines. I think it was caught off guard. But Russia did use that as a very effective opportunity to stop the violence, was the only actor capable to stop it, but also quickly and immediately brought in its troops as a peacekeeping force. I do agree with Derek. I mean, if Russia did not have interests that she listed, Russia would not be there. I'm not questioning that. But at the same time, I think arguing that these conflicts are emerging and they're not resolved because of Russia, it obscures more than it reveals, simply because some of these conflicts have pre-Soviet imperial roots, some going into the Russian Empire. But more importantly, I think since the post-Cold War period, I think the West has done a lot in fueling conditions for this conflict. Quick points. Number one, with the Western energy diplomacy, whether it's with Central Asia or in the case of Azerbaijan and South Caucasus, the West participated in nourishing authoritarianism, this highly illegitimate elites in these countries, which makes it very, very difficult to solve conflicts through institutional forms. So I think we have to be careful in simply arguing that the Russian imperial narrative will explain. If only Russia disappeared, these conflicts would be solved. I don't think that would be the case. And also in regards to the Russian imperial foreign policy, I think whether we look at that's a variable. I think imperialism, new imperialism is very much a variable. Looking at, we were talking a little bit before this with Erica about her colleague, Jeff Menkoff, has a new book on Eurasia's empires, where he actually analyzes this. The book came out before the war in Ukraine, Russia, Turkey, Iran, China, that there is this tendency. So these actors really playing a new imperial role, and the mechanisms are really varied. Is Russia right now would be not a very malign actor? Absolutely. This is a war of conquest. It has used the conflicts for its goals, for its own reasons. But I do think that overall, I think the West, particularly the United States, when enjoying this hegemony, unipolar moment, really is increasingly and rightfully criticized for not using that period well. The two much criticized interventions in Iraq in particular, less so in Afghanistan, has done a lot of damage in weakening the rules-based world order, allowing elevating terrorism as a paramount political goal, which then allows players like Putin and now increasingly Turkey and Azerbaijan, whenever there is a dissatisfaction, discrimination, minority issues, slapping the terrorism label on it. So that's one. But one more important factor in regards to this conflict as to how Russia is using these conflicts is when the Soviet Union disintegrated, the West quickly recognize all the 15 republics, playing lip service to the minority, simply nudging and simply requesting for these 15 republics to take care of the minorities, which of course did not happen. So it's these pre-existing security cleavages that Putin is utilizing. And conflicts are very complicated as phenomena, and understanding economy, institutions, security risks, all of that goes in it. So we have to be careful as to what extent we view Russia as the causal or facilitating factor. But the fact that Russia benefits has been, Kremlin, I should say, has benefited from it, not Russia. I agree with that. Yeah. I did not answer your question on Armenia-Russia relationships, I'm realizing.
Right, yeah, no, Has the relationship between Armenia and Russia been fractured as well?
I think looking at Russia's relationship with its Armenia, Georgia, Azerbaijan, all of the republics, it really matters as to what kind of a state we're talking about in these peripheries. The relationship, Armenia has not done U-turn after 2020, after the Ukraine war, but the anti-Russia sentiments have grown tremendously, especially after the Ukraine war. But in terms of in all of the international forums, Armenia has managed to stay neutral and did not vote the way Russia would like. So that probably has aggravated Russia behind closed doors. So I think as to whether a relationship is fractured, I wouldn't say so. I don't think Russia has demonstrated a capacity to do a lot of damage in some of the states. So I don't think it'd be wise anyone to, in this post-Soviet states, to push back against Russia. So relationship hasn't fractured. There is no U-turn. But at the same time, the public sentiment, there is a lot deeper public sentiment against Russia, especially when their forces some protesting at the moment with all kinds of links to Russian economy, and their worries that Russia will push Armenia to join into this union state, which is not likely. But that fear is very much there among within the public.
And Erica Murat, that kind of raises this question then. Russia's tried to make themselves indispensable within the region. If Russia withdraws or, you know, is challenged, certainly in Central Asia, the United States has withdrawn from the region, at least withdrawn from Afghanistan. Is this going to create a power rivalry within the region? Or what's the best way to manage Russia's withdrawing or at least losing influence in the region?
So I don't think Russia is losing influence in the region for now. What is true is that, like in Armenia, like in other parts of territories that were formerly occupied by the Soviet regime, there are more people who are seeing Russia as a belligerent neighbor, not a kind of big brother type of neighbor who only brings economic development and political stability to Central Asia, but actually a dangerous neighbor. And for many people, what's going on in Ukraine right now, the atrocities, the inhumane violence, the genocide in Ukraine, it reminds them or it makes them think of how the Soviet Union was created in Central Asia, especially. And there is a big difference how the Bolsheviks advanced in Central Asia compared to South Caucasus. Cultures were erased in Central Asia. Ethnicities were erased. 40% of present-day Kazakhstan population was starved to death. So the level of atrocities 100 years ago was unimaginable. And now more people are questioning whether the Soviet Union was actually an evil or really negative part, traumatic part of those nations' histories. And what can we do? How do we move on from this traumatic past? How would you acknowledge it? And how would we discuss it? And how do we build something on top of it? And when we talk about the present day reality, there has always been some degree of competition between Russia, China, United States, and Turkey, Iran. There has been collaboration between autocrats as well. But the truth is, Central Asian countries can decide for themselves who they want to collaborate with. And the current presidents, they do try to balance between different powers, regional and global powers. Some are more successful than others. For instance, bigger states like Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan that offer more economic opportunities to Western and Chinese companies, they are able to better balance between different countries. And hopefully, Russian political influence and cultural influence in Central Asia declines over time, because as I wrote in my piece that you cited earlier, Russian embassies in Central Asian countries really intervene into day-to-day discussions about the meaning of Russia, the meaning of the Soviet regime and those nations' identities. It's this diplomacy that Russia has adopted recently, that there is this sense of entitlement among diplomats to point at what Central Asian countries and the people should think about Russia and the Soviet regime. They go to events, they issue statements, they try to promote propaganda movies about Donbas, and that has to end. And hopefully this war will weaken Russia's influence, both within Central Asia and the extent that Russia would be able to exert pressure on Central Asia.
And you're listening to Scholar Circle. ScholarCircle.org. We're discussing the impact of the war in Ukraine on Russia's influence throughout the rest of this post-Soviet space with Anna Ohanian of Stonehill College and Erica Murat of National Defense University. Erica, I kind of want to come back, since you talked about broadly some of these identity questions. Here in the West, the general impression that we're getting is that, you know, what's really taking a hit with respect to Russia's image, with respect to, you know, Russian interests, is its leadership. That the problem with Russia is that it is at best a corrupted democracy, if it's a democracy at all. The role that Vladimir Putin is playing, the role that his close advisors and oligarchs are playing, and the expectation that if Putin is replaced, then a lot of this is going to be rehabilitated. How accurate is that description?
This is a very convenient and narrow understanding of what's going on. If only Putin is removed, things will be better in Russia. But I'm glad to see a change, a shift in the past 3 months, that it's not so much Putinism that held accountable and his oligarchs held accountable for the atrocities in Ukraine, but it's actually the word imperialism is used more and more frequently. And if we see the kind of discussions that many Russian scholars and even opposition leaders have in Russia, they also tend to criticize Putin, but they never really challenge this idea of Russian imperialism, that Russia is still controlling, coercing a lot of the nations within the Russian Federation without giving them voice. So I'm not arguing for, you know, for disintegration of Russia or anything like that, but without giving them voice, without granting them equal citizenship rights, at least de facto. They also tend to blame Putin. But for many of the scholars from non-Russian republic, you know, from Central Asia, from Ukraine, from South Caucasus as well, it's been imperialism all this way. We see how it's just in mainstream scholarly discussions in Russia, there is this still sense, this implicit sense of the implicit identity that Russia brought a lot of good things to those colored republics, you know, non-white republics, or in Central Asia, or to Ukrainians, that bringing Russian culture and Soviet culture was a gift of greatness, something that modernized those nations, not oppressed, but modernized and made them better. And this implicit sense of identity, imperial identity, is unfortunately not discussed still in mainstream scholarly and expert discussions in Russia. But it has to happen at some point, because it is all about the idea that Russia has this entitlement to influence countries that it borders with, that it can't be an equal partner. Even if it can't offer economic collaboration, it can still impose its culture, its worldview. And that sense has to be discussed within Russia. Within West, the discussions are happening because there is more freedom of speech, there are more voices, there are more discussions, free-flowing discussions, but that discussion still has to happen in Russia. Something similar to what happened in post-Nazi Germany, that there was a really in-depth examining of own identity, of own domestic and foreign policy, and that has to happen in Russia as well.
And Anna, I'll ask you the same question. If the Russian leadership changes, and I know that there's kind of this perception that the war in Ukraine probably doesn't end unless Ukraine collapses or unless Putin is replaced in power, would a replacement of Putin and a democratization in Russia alter the equation pretty dramatically?
I'm not sure that Russia has a Putin problem. I do agree with Erica that some of the problems precede Putin. Brian Taylor has a good book, The Code of Putinism, where he argues that Putinism was there before Putin came along, meaning that there are certain, in terms of institutions, actually, Russia under Kremlin has, under Putin in particular, has steadily eroded, undermined civil societies. Now, actually, we can't even pretend that Russia is even some level of competitive authoritarian hybrid regime. It's a full-blown, deep authoritarian state bordering on totalitarianism, simply because just the fact that you cannot even use the word war to describe the Russian invasion. The propaganda machine is controlled by the Kremlin. So when you have such elimination of civil society institutions, the recovery, even the removing regimes is not, it might sound counterintuitive, but in political transformations, removing a regime is the easy part. And what comes after that is the challenge. Egypt is a good model, right? During the Arab Spring, the authoritarian regime was removed, but Egypt is back to being a military authoritarian state. Many of the countries in the Arab Spring followed this trajectory. So if we compare Russia within this framework, then Russia is not, I mean, it's the population is highly educated, of course. So there has been some civil society mostly focused on social and humanitarian issues. Political society has been crushed. So it's unclear. The conditions are not that great that if Putin leaves, that Russia will move towards being a normal democratic state. The liberal wing in Russia has been quite weak. And Putin actually, within the political spectrum in Russia, is somewhere sort of right of center to a certain extent in terms of the identity issue, meaning that it did not really fully move into the sort of the extreme right-wing policy simply because it would have made it difficult for Russia to have this imperial foreign policy. So with Putin, I think he has followed largely sort of this Eurasian identity, trying to sell this image that Russia is neither European nor Asian, but it has this unique space, that is this unique identity. So in that respect, I mean, the fact that this is a country that eliminated civil society institutions, political society is pretty stale, identity issues have not been aired out, there is very little civic nationalism, very little sort of people have, Navalny has done so many protests. I mean, but still people, the numbers were not there. Erika Chenoweth's work, Marie Stephan's work is very important here. You need significant numbers of people to mobilize in order to move the regime and then pick up the pieces after he's gone. So I think there are several issues that are, the conditions are not favorable. And of course, the fact that it's a federation, multi-ethnic federation, then that creates a whole new set of challenges that Erika described.
Erika, you want to respond as well?
Yeah, I just want to follow up on what Anna said. I think, Anna, you brought the example of Navalny, and I completely agree that he has an effective message, but not too many people joined him. But that just shows, if we look at Russia broadly, and if we feel like when Putin is removed, then maybe Putinism will go away. But Navalny, in many aspects, he's very similar to Putin in how he sees ethnic minorities and Russia's foreign policy. He was one of those people who actually supported annexation of Crimea. He condemns now the war in Ukraine, of course, but he has a long track record of saying racist and misogynistic things against minorities in Russia. So again, goes back to this imperial identity that is never really questioned in Russia and is taken for granted, and it continues to reproduce itself.
I agree. I mean, Navalny's weakness was that he was a nationalist, particularly in his political career. The Putin that we see now has been a process. He has not been pursuing narrowly nationalistic ideas prescribed by Navalny. So, I mean, this war in Ukraine was very much, and the speech preceding it was a very imperial message, but it took, in terms of rhetoric and discourse, it took some time for Putin to get there. He always kind of played both games formally. He always talked about multipolarity, and it kind of sounded almost abnormal in world politics. But informally, obviously, he had all kinds of levers into the 15 republics. But Navalny's case, Navalny protests, the fact that he was so nationalist, that the fact that he failed to reach out to build bridges through all of the nationalities is the reason as to why, one of the reasons I would say, as to why his messaging did not resonate. But it also, I think the society in Russia in general is politically conservative. And Russia, the narrative has been fed by the Kremlin to Russians that if you come out as a revolution, whenever Russians engage in a revolution, the state collapses. So there is that narrative that plays in a way that it makes people hesitant to come out. And of course, I think resource-rich countries, there has been a social contract. People keep their mouths shut, stay out of politics, and things will be okay and tolerable. And I think it's that social contract that has been holding up. We'll see whether that social contract would hold as the sanctions and this economic containment that has been applied on Russia afterwards.
And Erika, I'll give you the last word on this.
Yes, sorry. Anna keeps bringing really interesting points on social contract. And I think there is this paradox. On the one hand, many Russians, I tend to think it's majority of Russians, but opinions vary, support the war in Ukraine. But at the same time, they're willing to tolerate economic decline. And maybe not all parts of the Russian population feel the economic decline, but we saw those images of people fighting for sugar, waiting in long lines and all that, right? But that just shows that the social contract is, of course, economic, but it's also identity-based. And Putin was able to raise this militant patriotism that Russia is presented on the one hand as the victim of the West, Western expansion and aggression on the one hand, but also again, entitled to neighboring territories, entitled to the territory of Ukraine. So this victim perpetrator identity, it keeps reproducing itself. It justifies violence because others are abusing us, because others are being bad to us. And for those who support the war in Ukraine, they genuinely feel that Russia is doing it because of the West, because of what West is doing.
Absolutely. I think what we're taking from this is that the war in Ukraine has certainly exposed, laid bare certain political, social, and identity trends within Russia that the other populations in the post-Soviet space are absolutely taking notice of this and is playing a significant role. And if there is any hope for trying to, you know, truly mend these fractures, it's going to take political change within Russia and a great deal of historical soul searching as well. So if nothing else, let's hope that the war ends and that this process can begin. We've been discussing the impact of Russia's invasion in Ukraine and the fracturing of its relationship with the other nations in the post-Soviet space. Our panelists today have been Anna Ohanian, Richard B. Finnegan, Distinguished Professor of Political Science and International Relations at Stonehill College. She is the editor of Russia Abroad, Driving Regional Fracture in Post-Communist Eurasia and Beyond, and her new book, due out in August, is The Neighborhood Effect, The Imperial Roots of Regional Fracture in Post-Communist Eurasia. And Erica Marat, Associate Professor and Chair of the Regional and Analytic Studies Department at the College of International Security Affairs, National Defense University. She's the author of The Politics of Police Reform, Society Against the State in Post-Soviet Countries, and Time to Question Russia's Imperial Innocence. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
I'd like to give a special thanks to the Scholar Circle team, Maria Armudian, the host and anchor, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongri, webmaster and production assistant. All Scholar Circle shows are archived on scholarcircle.org. You can find our podcast on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle Twitter account, and please join our Facebook page. On behalf of the Scholar Circle team, I am Doug Becker. Thank you for listening.